This was to prevent any overreactions to every personage born in a particular country who might seem to fit descriptions and dates given. This would be very unfair and misleading. 3. For the same reason, Seth wouldn't say more at this time concerning the Indian religious figure and the to-be-born African who would work in Indonesia. Resume at 10:50.
Now, let us continue. Rupert was correct in the answers he just gave you. I would like to make certain points clear. The new religion following the second coming will not be Christian in your terms, although the third personality of Christ will initiate it. This personality will refer to the historical Christ, will recognize his relationship with that personality, but within him the three personality groupings will form a new psychic entity, a different psychological gestalt. As this metamorphosis takes place, it will initiate a metamorphosis on a human level also, as man's inner abilities are accepted and developed. The results will be a different kind of existence. Many of your problems now result from spiritual ignorance. No man will look down upon an individual from another race when he himself recognizes that his own existence includes such membership also.
10:55.
No sex will be considered better than the other, or any role in society, when each individual is aware of his own or her own experience at many levels of society and in many roles. An open-ended consciousness will feel its connections with all other living beings.
Pause.
The continuity of consciousness will become apparent. As a result of all this, the social and governmental structures will change, for they are based upon your current beliefs. Human personality will reap benefits that now would seem unbelievable. An open-ended consciousness will imply far greater freedom. From birth, children will be taught that basic identity is not dependent upon the body, and that time, as you know it, is an illusion. The child will be aware of many of its past existences, and will be able to identify with the old man or woman that in your terms it will become.
11:02.
Many of the lessons that come with age will then be available to the young, but the old will not lose the spiritual elasticity of their youth. This itself is important. But for some time, future incarnations will still be hidden for practical reasons. As these changes come about, new areas will be activated in the brain to physically take care of them. Physically, then, brain mappings will be possible in which past life memories are evoked. All of these alterations are spiritual changes in which the meaning of religion will escape organizational bounds, become a living part of individual existence, and where psychic frameworks rather than physical ones form the foundations for civilization.
Pause. Eyes closed at 11:05.
Man's experience will be so extended that to you, the species will seem to have changed into another. This does not mean there will not be problems. It does mean that man will have far greater resources at his command. It also presupposes a richer and far more diverse social framework. Men and women will find themselves relating to their brethren not only as the people that they are, but as the people that they were. Family relationships will show perhaps the greatest changes. There will be room for emotional interactions within the family that are now impossible. The conscious mind will be more aware of unconscious material. I am including this information in this chapter on religion because it is important that you realize that spiritual ignorance is at the basis of so many of your problems, and that indeed your only limitations are spiritual ones.
11:14.
The metamorphosis mentioned earlier on the part of the third personality will have such strength and power that it will call out from mankind these same qualities from within itself. The qualities have always been present. They will finally break through the veils of physical perception, extending that perception in new ways. Now, mankind lacks such a focus. The third personality will represent that focus. There will be, incidentally, no crucifixion in that drama. That personality will indeed be multidimensional, aware of all its incarnations. It will not be oriented in terms of one sex, one color, or one race.
11:20.
For the first time, therefore, it will break through the earthly concepts of personality, liberating personality. It will have the ability to show these diverse effects as it chooses. There will be many who will be afraid to accept the nature of their own reality or to be shown the dimensions of true identity. For several reasons, as mentioned by Rupert, I do not want to give any more detailed information as to the name that will be used or the land of birth. Too many might be tempted to jump into that image prematurely. Events are not predestined. The framework for this emergence has already been set, however, within your system of probabilities. The emergence of this third personality will directly affect the original historical drama of Christ as it is now known. There is and must be interactions between them. You may take your break or end the session as you prefer.
We'll take the break. 11:25. I asked for a break on the chance that more information might come through for the chapter. Jane said she couldn't remember any of the data given since last break. She'd had no sense of time passing while in trance. Both of us were getting tired. We were also hungry. So we thought of ending the session and watching an old mystery or horror movie on TV while we had something to eat. Then I remembered that Seth hadn't given headings for the first 8 chapters of his book. He had told us not to worry about this in chapter 17. Could he give the headings now, or would Jane have to go over that early material first? Impossible as it seemed, well over a year had passed since she had stopped reading the book, session by session, early in chapter 4. Resume at 11:39.
Now, I will bid you a fond good evening after a few remarks in answer to your question. Again, Rupert picked this up from me this afternoon, when I deviated from the original outline as given.
In the 510th session for January 19th, 1970,
I gave chapter headings. Otherwise, those statements made in the outline apply. You can simply add them if you prefer. I inserted many chapters where none were mentioned, and so used the headings from then onward. Now, do you have more questions?
Yes, but I guess we'll ask them later. Humorously, eyes wide and very dark.
You did not come to ESP class, so you could not have missed me very much.
I missed you a great deal.
We will have a personal session also, and continue with our book. And I missed our private sessions.
So did I.
You can still record and chat with me without notes some evening for your own freedom.
That's why I'm having our recorder fixed.
My fondest regards then, and good evening.
Thank you very much, Seth. It's been a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure.
I laughed at the humorous emphasis. Good night. End at 11:45 p.m. Session 587, July 28, 1971, 9:17 p.m., Wednesday.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, We will resume dictation. The exterior religious dramas are, of course, imperfect representations of the ever-unfolding interior spiritual realities. The various personages, the gods and prophets within religious history, these absorb the mass inner projections thrown out by those inhabiting a given time span. Such religious dramas focus, direct and hopefully, clarify aspects of inner reality that need to be physically represented.
Long pause, eyes closed.
These do not only appear within your own system. Many are also projected into other systems of reality. Religion, per se, however, is always the external facade of inner reality. The primary spiritual existence alone gives meaning to the physical one. In the more real terms, religion should include all of the pursuits of man in his search for the nature of meaning and truth. Spirituality cannot be some isolated, specialized activity or characteristic. Exterior religious dramas are important and valuable only to the extent that they faithfully reflect the nature of inner, private, spiritual existence. To the extent that a man feels that his religion expresses such inner experience, he will feel it valid. Most religions, per se, however, set up as permissible certain groups of experiences while denying others. They limit themselves by applying the principles of the sacredness of life only to your own species, and often to highly limited groups within it.
Pause at 9:30.
At no time will any given church be able to express the inner experience of all individuals. At no time will any church find itself in a position in which it can effectively curtail the inner experience of its members. It will only seem to do so. The forbidden experiences will simply be unconsciously expressed, gather strength and vitality, and rise up to form a counter-projection, which will then form another, newer, exterior religious drama. The dramas themselves do express certain inner realities, and they serve as surface reminders to those who do not trust direct experience with the inner self. They will take the symbols as reality. When they discover that this is not so, they feel betrayed. Christ spoke in terms of the Father and Son because in your terms at that time, this was the method used. The story he told to explain the relationship between the inner self and the physically alive individual. No new religion really startles anyone, for the drama has already been played subjectively. What I have said, of course, applies as much to Buddha as it does to Christ. Both accepted the inner projections and then tried to physically represent these. They were more, however, than the sum of those projections. This also should be understood. Mohammedanism fell far short. In this case, the projections were of violence predominating. Love and kinship were secondary to what indeed amounted to baptism and communion through violence and blood. In these continuous exterior religious dramas, the Hebrews played a strange role. Their idea of one God was not new to them. Many ancient religions held the belief of one God above all others. This God above all others was a far more lenient God, however, than the one the Hebrews followed. Many tribes believed, quite rightly, in the inner spirit that pervades each living thing, and they often referred to, say, the God in the tree or the spirit in the flower, but they also accepted the reality of an overall spirit, of which these lesser spirits were but a part. All worked together harmoniously. The Hebrews conceived of an overseer God, an angry and just and sometimes cruel God, and many sects denied then the idea that other living beings beside man possessed inner spirits. The earlier beliefs represented a far better representation of inner reality in which man, observing nature, let nature speak and reveal its secrets.
9:45.
The Hebrew God, however, represented a projection of a far different kind. Man was growing more and more aware of the ego, of a sense of power over nature, and many of the later miracles are presented in such a way that nature is forced to behave differently than in its usual mode. God becomes man's ally against nature. The early Hebrew God became a symbol of man's unleashed ego. God behaved exactly as an enraged child would, had he those powers, sending thunder and lightning and fire against his enemies, destroying them. Man's emerging ego, therefore, brought forth emotional and psychological problems and challenges. The sense of separation from nature grew. Nature became a tool to use against others. Sometime before the emergence of the Hebrew God, these tendencies were apparent. In many ancient, now forgotten tribal religions, recourse was also made to the gods to turn nature against the enemy. Before this time, however, man felt a part of nature, not separated from it. It was regarded as an extension of his being, as he felt an extension of its reality. One cannot use oneself as a weapon against oneself in those terms. In those times, men spoke and confided to the spirits of birds, trees, and spiders, knowing that in the interior reality beneath, the nature of these communications was known and understood. In those times, death was not feared as it is in your terms now, for the cycle of consciousness was understood. Man desired in one way to step out of himself, out of the framework in which he had his psychological existence, to try new challenges, to step out of a mode of consciousness into another. He wanted to study the process of his own consciousness. In one way, this meant a giant separation from the inner spontaneity that had given him both peace and security. On the other hand, it offered a new creativity in his terms. I suggest your break before I get into that.
10:01. Jane's pace had speeded up considerably after a slow start. I told her the material was excellent. Tonight's session was being held in our living room, since the house was empty except for us. The air conditioner had been on since before the session, yet Jane felt warm at break. In trance, she said, she hadn't been bothered by any sort of physical discomfort. During break, I went over a few questions about the relationships between the three members of the Christ entity, John the Baptist, Jesus Christ, and Paul. After listening for a bit, Jane asked me not to pursue this subject now. She suggested I ask these questions at the end of the chapter, if Seth hadn't volunteered the answers before then. Resume at 10:13.
Now, at this point, the God inside became the God outside. Man tried to form a new realm, attain a different kind of focus and awareness. His consciousness turned a corner outside of itself. To do this, he concentrated less and less upon inner reality, and therefore began the process of inner reality only as it was projected outward into the physical world. Before, the environment was effortlessly created and perceived by man and all other living things, knowing the nature of their inner unity. In order to begin this new venture, it was necessary to pretend that this inner unity did not exist. Otherwise, the new kind of consciousness would always run back to its home for security and comfort. So it seemed that all bridges must be cut, while of course it was only a game, because the inner reality always remained. The new kind of consciousness simply had to look away from it to maintain initially an independent focus. I am speaking here in more or less historic terms for you. You must realize that the process has nothing to do with time as you know it, however. This particular kind of adventure in consciousness has occurred before, and, in your terms, will again.
Here Seth was making a little joke, for Jane has been doing some writing lately which she has tentatively entitled Adventures in Consciousness.
Perception of the exterior universe then changed, however, and it seemed to be alien and apart from the individual who perceived it.
10:24.
God, therefore, became an idea projected outward, independent of the individual, divorced from nature. He became the reflection of man's emerging ego, with all of its brilliance, savagery, power, and intent for mastery. The adventure was a highly creative one, despite the obvious disadvantages, and represented an evolution of consciousness that enriched man's subjective experience, and indeed added to the dimensions of reality itself. To be effectively organized, however, inner and outer experience had to appear as separate, disconnected events. Historically, the characteristics of God changed as man's ego changed. These characteristics of the ego, however, were supported by strong inner changes.
Jane, as Seth, gestured emphatically and often as she spoke. Her pace had been fast since her break.
The original propulsion of inner characteristics outward into the formation of the ego could be compared with the birth of innumerable stars, an event of immeasurable consequences that originated on a subjective level and within inner reality. The ego, having its birth from within, therefore, must always boast of its independence while maintaining the nagging certainty of its inner origin.
Pause at 10:30. Still in trance, Jane took time to sip at a beer and light a cigarette. Then,
we'll have a good chapter.
Great.
The ego feared for its position, frightened that it would dissolve back into the inner self from which it came. Yet in its emergence, it provided the inner self with a new kind of feedback, a different view not only of itself, but through this, the inner self was able to glimpse possibilities of development of which it had not previously been aware. In your terms, by the time of Christ, the ego was sure enough of its position so that the projected picture of God could begin to change. The inner self is in a state of constant growth. The inner portion of each man, therefore, projected this knowledge outward. The need, the psychological and spiritual need of the species, demanded both interior and exterior alterations of great import. Qualities of mercy and understanding that had been buried could now surface. Not only privately, but en masse, they surged up, adding a new impetus and giving a natural new direction, beginning to call all portions of the self as it knew itself together.
10:38.
So the concept of God began to change as the ego recognized its reliance upon inner reality, but the drama had to be worked out within the current framework. Mohammedanism was basically so violent precisely because Christianity was basically so gentle. Not that Christianity was not mixed with violence, or that Mohammedanism was devoid of love. But as the psyche went through its developments and battled with itself, denying some feelings and characteristics and stressing others, so the historic religious exterior dramas represented and followed these inner aspirations, struggles, and searches.
Slower now.
All of this material now given must be considered along with the fact that beneath these developments, there are the eternal aspects and creative characteristics of a force that is both undeniable and intimate. All that is, in other words, represents the reality from which all of us spring.
Pause. One of several.
All that is, by its nature, transcends all dimensions of activity, consciousness, or reality, while being a part of each.
10:45.
Behind all faces, there is one face. Yet this does not mean that each man's face is not his own. The further religious drama of which I have spoken in your terms still to come represents another stage in both the internal and external dramas in which the emergent ego becomes aware of much of its heritage. While maintaining its own status, it will be able to have much greater commerce with other portions of the self, and also to offer to the inner self opportunities of awareness that the inner self on its own could not procure. The journeys of the gods, therefore, represent the journeys of man's own consciousness projected outward. All that is, however, is within each such adventure. Its consciousness and its reality is within each man and within the gods he has created. That last is in small letters, and gods shall always be in small letters. All that is capitalized. The gods attain, of course, a psychic reality. I am not saying, therefore, that they are not real, but I am to some extent defining the nature of their reality. It is to some extent true to say, be careful of the gods you choose, for you will reinforce each other. Now, take a break.
10:55. The pace had been consistently fast, and my writing hand felt it. As Seth had promised, it was a good chapter. Jane said she could feel him pause briefly at times to make sure that she chose just the right word while delivering the material. She would still be in trance, she said, and even speaking, but Seth would wait. Yet she didn't remember any of the material at break. Resume at 11:08 with the air conditioner still on.
Now, such an alliance sets up certain fields of attraction. A man who attaches himself to one of the gods is necessarily attaching himself largely to his own projections. Some, in your terms, are creative and some destructive, though the latter are seldom recognized as such. The open concept of all that is, however, frees you to a great extent from your own projections and allows a more valid contact with the spirit that is behind the reality that you know. In this chapter, I would also like to mention several other pertinent points. Some ancient tales have come down through the centuries that tell of various gods and demons who guard the gates, so to speak, of other levels of reality and stages of consciousness. Astral levels are neatly laid out, numbered, and categorized. There are tests to pass before entry. There are rituals to be acted out. Now, all of this is highly distorted. Any attempt to so rigorously and precisely express inner reality is bound to be abortive, highly misleading, and in your terms, sometimes dangerous. For you do create your own reality and live it according to your inner beliefs. Therefore, be careful also of those beliefs that you accept. Let me take this moment to state again that there are no devils or demons except as you create them out of your belief. As mentioned earlier, good and evil effects are basically illusions. In your terms, all acts, regardless of their seeming nature, are a part of a greater good. I am not saying that a good end justifies what you would consider an evil action. While you still accept the effects of good and evil, then you had better choose the good.
11:25.
I am saying this as simply as possible. There are profound complications beneath my words, however. Opposites have validity only in your own system of reality. They are a part of your root assumptions, and so you must deal with them as such. They represent, however, deep unities that you do not understand. Your conception of good and evil results in large part from the kind of consciousness you have presently adopted. You do not perceive wholes, but portions. The conscious mind focuses with a quick, limited, but intense light, perceiving from a given field of reality only certain stimuli. It then puts these stimuli together, forming the liaison of similarity. Anything that it does not accept as a portion of reality, it does not perceive. The effect of opposites results then from a lack of perception. Since you must operate within the world as you perceive it, then the opposites will appear to be conditions of existence. These elements have been isolated for a certain reason, however. You are being taught, and you are teaching yourselves to handle energy, to become conscious co-creators with all that is, and one of the stages of development or learning processes includes dealing with opposites as realities. In your terms, the idea of good and evil help you recognize the sacredness of existence, the responsibility of consciousness. The ideas of opposites also are necessary guidelines for the developing ego. The inner self knows quite well the unity that exists. Now, end of dictation, and very near the end of the chapter. And at the end of the chapter, ask those questions that you have in mind.
Okay. As the chapter progressed, though, Seth was automatically answering many of our questions about religion. Originally, we'd included these in our list for chapter 20.
I bid you a fond good evening, and...
with smiling emphasis...
we were in great form last evening.
Hey, you certainly were. Thank you, Seth. And good night. 11:57 p.m. Seth referred to Jane's ESP class. A long session had been recorded during the class, as happens quite often, and it can be added that Seth was in great form this evening, too. Session 588, August 2, 1971, 9:01 p.m., Monday. Jane and I each noted questions before the session this evening. In the 586th session, earlier in this chapter, Seth stated that by the year 2075, the third Christ, Paul or Saul, would have enacted the second coming, exerting, of course, a profound effect upon religion and world history. Jane thought a period of less than a century was much too short a time to encompass so many dramatic changes. She wanted me to ask Seth if she had distorted this data while delivering it. When, for instance, would the personality be born in order to have time to bring about such tremendous changes? We suppose there was a chance distortion had occurred. My questions concerned relationships between the three personalities of the Christ entity, John the Baptist, Jesus Christ, and Paul. What sort of psychic interactions had taken place between them in any strong or exceptional way? Were there dreams and other psychic experiences, other than the recorded instances, outstanding on a regular basis as they lived out their lives day by day? All of the following historical dates are quite approximate, but they show the overlapping pattern of the physical lives of the three personalities making up the Christ entity. John the Baptist was born between 8 and 4 BC and died in AD 26 to 27. Jesus Christ was born between 8 and 5 BC and died in AD 29 to 30. Paul, Saul, of Tarsus, was born between AD 5 and 15 and died in AD 67 to 68. Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, was a cousin of Christ's mother, Mary. John baptized Christ at the beginning of his ministry in AD 26 to 27 when he was about 30. John was already active in his own ministry and often called himself a forerunner of one who would be nobler and stronger. Shortly after he baptized Jesus, John was imprisoned by Herod Antipas, in the fortress Mahiris, near the Dead Sea. It isn't known for sure that Christ and Paul ever met. Paul was converted several years after Christ's death. Before that, he had been a zealous persecutor of Christians. Nor does it appear that John and Paul met. According to history, all three members of the Christ entity met violent ends. Christ was crucified near Jerusalem at the order of Pontius Pilate. Herod had John beheaded, and Paul was beheaded near Rome during the reign of Nero. Readers of the Seth material had asked Seth to elaborate upon data of the three Christs given in chapter 18, the God concept, of that book. Some wanted to know if one of the three Christs could have been the teacher of righteousness. This personage was the leader of the Zealot sect in Judea early in the first century AD. There were four known Jewish sects flourishing there at the birth of Christianity. Other questions concerned a variety of names for Christ himself. Jane and I had been saving these, and we went over them now before the session. Jane's pace, as the session opened, was quite a bit slower than usual.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, give us a moment and we will resume. In any given historical period, one religious drama may finally emerge as the exterior representation, but there will also be many minor dramas, projections that do not entirely take. These represent, of course, probable events. Any of them could supersede the actual exterior drama. In the time of Christ, there were many such performances, as many personalities felt the force of inner reality and reacted to it. There were probable Christs, in other words, living in your terms at that time. For several reasons that I will not go into here, these projections did not mirror inner events faithfully enough. There were, however, a score of men in the same general area, physically, who responded to the inner psychic climate and felt upon themselves the attraction and responsibility of the religious hero.
Pause at 9:09.
Some of these men were too tinged, too caught in the torment and fervor of the period to rise sufficiently above it. The cultures used them. They could not use the various cultures as launching ground for the new ideas. Instead, they became lost in the history of the times. Some carried on following the same pattern taken by Christ, performed psychic feats and healings, had groups of followers, and yet were not capable of holding that powerful focus of psychic attention that was so necessary. The Lord of Righteousness, so-called, was such a person, but his overzealous nature held him back.
In the literature I've been reading on the subject, the zealot leader was always called the teacher of righteousness. The interpretation of scanty records, including the Dead Sea Scrolls, has given rise to debate. But it appears he was either Menachem ben Judah, who was killed in AD 66 in Jerusalem, or a nephew, who survived and succeeded him.
His rigidity prevented the spontaneity necessary for any true great religious release. He fell instead into the trap of provincialism. Had he performed the role possible, he could have been of benefit to Paul. He was a probable personality of the Paul portion of the Christ entity.
Long pause at 9:17. Jane's pace was still quite slow.
These men innately understood their part in this drama and also their position within all that is. They were all highly clairvoyant and telepathic, given to visions and hearing of voices. In their dreams, they were in contact. Consciously, Paul remembered many of these dreams until he felt pursued by Christ. It was because of a series of recurring dreams that Paul persecuted the Christians. He felt that Christ was a kind of devil who pursued him in his sleep. On an unconscious level, however, he knew the meaning of the dreams, and his conversion, of course, was only a physical event following an inner experience. John the Baptist, Christ, and Paul were all connected in the dream state, and John was well aware of Christ's existence before Christ was born. Paul needed the strongest egotistical strength because of his particular duties. He was far less aware consciously of his role for this reason. The inner knowledge, of course, exploded in the physical conversion experience. This material has been given in answer to your questions.
It's very interesting. Jane took a long pause at 9:25. Still entranced, she lit a cigarette and sipped a drink.
Now, in answer to Rupert's question, the birth will occur at the time given, by the time given.
The year 2075.
The other changes will occur generally over the period of a century, but the results will show far before that time. Because of the plastic nature of the future, in your terms, the date cannot be considered final. All probabilities point in its direction, however, for the inner impetus is already forming the events. Unless you have other questions, that is the end of the chapter.
As a matter of curiosity, can you say how the teacher of righteousness met his end? This is one of the questions correspondents have asked.
Give us a moment. The name given was correct, though it is itself a translation. He died with a small group of men in a cave that he held as a point of refuge in the middle of a battle, killed by members of another sect. The murderers took with them certain manuscripts that they found there, but others they did not find, and these have not as yet come to light. The final place of refuge was near Damascus. For some time, the Lord of Righteousness tried to hide himself within the city. His identity was discovered, however, and he and a band of men took to caves that were between Damascus and another nearby town, much smaller, that had been used at one time as a fortress. They were heading there. Now, you may take your break, and then I will begin the next chapter.
9:35. But instead of taking a break, Jane sat quietly, still in trance.
One small note for those interested. The Zealots, the sect, were also divided into two main groups, one splitting finally from the other main one. Other documents will be found that will clear several important matters concerning the historical times.
Pause.
During one short period of his life, Paul joined a Zealot group. This is unknown. It has not been recorded.
Jane sat entranced so long that I began to ask a question, but then she raised a hand to indicate that I wait.
In fact, for a period he led a double life as a member of the Zealots. He turned against them vehemently, however, as he was later to turn against the Romans to join the Christians. Before his conversion, he knew he had a purpose and mission, and flung himself with all the passion of his being into whatever answers he thought he had found. Now, take your break.
9:40. Jane's pace had been slow to begin, but it picked up as her delivery progressed. Her trance had been deep. She said she really went out when Seth started in on the biblical data. I was finding Seth's information intensely interesting. It was unavoidable in many cases. But Jane said she much preferred not to know anything about the historical period Seth would be discussing. She hadn't read anything about the Dead Sea Scrolls, for instance, although I'd explained a little about them to her at various times, nor is she familiar with the Bible. Of course, we hadn't known just how Seth was going to present his material in the chapter on religion, on the third Christ and related data. Both of us were surprised to hear him declare a connection between Paul and the Zealots. Many questions automatically came to our minds, but we had to stop somewhere, so we reluctantly decided not to ask them. Jane's attitude about biblical history is in keeping with her feelings about some other facets of her abilities. She has often told me she felt much freer giving a reading for a person when she wasn't acquainted with him. The same was true when she was trying for the contents of sealed envelopes. She preferred not to know who had prepared them, or their origin, etc. Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts. Copyrighted material. All rights reserved.
Chapter 22. A Goodbye and an Introduction. Aspects of Multidimensional Personality as Viewed Through My Own Experience.
Resume at 10 o'clock. Jane's voice, as Seth, was a little different from usual, more controlled, perhaps. Not quite as jovial or as much at ease.
Now, we will begin the next chapter, and we will call it A Goodbye and an Introduction, Aspects of Multidimensional Personality as Viewed Through My Own Experience.
That's all in the chapter heading?
Yes, a colon to separate the two divisions, and give us a moment. In the historical time of Christ, I was a man called Millenius in Rome. In that life, my main occupation was that of a merchant, but I was a highly curious gentleman, and my travels gave me access to many different groups of people. Physically, I was round and stout, not at all patrician in my bearing, and given to untidiness in my dress. We had a type of snuff made from a certain kind of straw. I used it constantly, often spilling some upon my robe. My house was in the busiest northwestern part of the city, just beyond what you would call the heart of town. Among my wares, I sold bells for donkeys. This may not sound like a very grand product, and yet families on the farms outside of Rome found these highly useful. Each had a special sound, and a family could tell by the sound of the bell their own donkey from innumerable similar ones.
10:08.
Donkeys were also used in many businesses within Rome itself as carriers of burden, particularly in the lower occupations. The number of bells, their particular pitch, even the colors, all had meaning. In the tumult of the city, the particular bells could be recognized, therefore, by the poor and by the slaves who waited to buy products, often wilted foods, from the laden carts. The bells were only a small portion of my business, which dealt largely with cloths and dyes, but they fascinated me. Because of my interest in them, I did far more traveling about the countryside and the region than any prudent man should. The bells became my hobby. My curiosity drove me to journey in search of different kinds of bells, and led me into contact with many people I would not otherwise have encountered.
10:11.
While I was not literate, I was shrewd and lively of mind. Special bells, I discovered, were used by various sects of Jews, both within Rome and without. While I was a Roman and a citizen, my citizenship meant little except for providing me with minimal safety as I went about my daily way, and in my business I encountered as many Jews as Romans. I was not too far above them socially.
This was Seth's first bit of humor in the chapter.
The Romans had no clear idea of the number of Jews in Rome at that time. They went by guesswork. The bells on donkeys belonging to the zealots had upon them the symbol of an eye.
Jane, as Seth, pointed to one of her eyes.
They came secretly into town, hiding as much from other Jews as from Romans. They were good bargainers and often did me out of more than I deserved to lose. I learned about the Lord of Righteousness from a cousin of his named Sharaba.
Can you spell that? Seth did so, and it turned out that our versions agreed. It can be seen from the above paragraphs that Seth shifts his physical location from Rome to Judea without saying just how or when he did so. I wanted to know more about the mechanics of the transfer, but decided not to interrupt further just now.
Who was as clearly as I could figure out at the time, a sacred assassin. He was drunk the night I spoke to him in a stinking stall outside of Jerusalem. It was he who told me about the symbol of the eye. He also told me that the man, Christ, was kidnapped by the Essenes. I did not believe him, nor at the time he told me did I know who Christ was.
Pause at 10:28. Jane's pace had been slow. The four major Jewish sects known to flourish in the Holy Land at the beginning of the first century were the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Zealots, and the Essenes.
At the time that Christ lived, his existence was known to very few, comparatively speaking. To put it bluntly, I knew that someone had the ball, but I was not certain of the person. In dream states, the situation finally became known to me and to many others. The Christians, generally speaking, did not want Roman converts. I was later one of these, and because of my nationality, was never trusted. My part in that drama was simply to acquaint myself with its physical foundation, to be a participant, however small, in that era. Much later, in your terms, I would end up as a minor pope in the 3rd century, meeting again some of those I had known, and, if you will forgive a humorous note, once more familiar with the sound of bells.
Seth first referred to his incarnation as a minor pope in Jane's ESP class session for May 15, 1971. Some 18 people were present. The session was recorded, so the quotes that follow are verbatim. Seth was in a high, if somewhat ribald, mood.
For I was a pope in AD 300. I was not a very good pope. I had 2 illegitimate children.
Class laughter.
A mistress that sneaked into my private study, a magician that I kept in case I did not do too well on my own, a housekeeper who was pregnant every year that I had her, and 3 daughters who joined a nunnery because I would not have them. And I am referred to in barely 3 paltry lines, for my reign did not last very long. Now, I had a large family, that is, I came from a large family, and I was ambitious, as all intelligent young men of that time were. I did not go for the military, so there was nothing to do but go to the church. For a while I was not in Rome, but held my religious call elsewhere. I wrote 2 church laws. It should all go to show you that some good ends up from everything. I died of trouble with my stomach because I was such a glutton. My name was not Clement, in answer to a question from a class member, although Clement is a lovely name. I was originally called Protonius. Now, give me a moment. The last name is not nearly so clear, and this is not my papal name, but my, if you will forgive the term, common name, Megalomanius III, from a small village. Unless I summon the self that I was at that time, the memories for details are not that clear. But as I now recall them, without directly checking on our friend the Pope, who has, you must understand, gone his own way, I am coming as close as I can. We did not have as many guards at that time, but we had many stolen paintings and jewels of great merit. Now some of these jewels, as well as the money, went for expeditions that you do not realize were adopted at the time, having to do with commerce and ships sent to Africa. And this interest had to do with my later life when I was involved with the oregano as a spice merchant in Denmark in the 1600s. My sniffing goes back for centuries. There were 2 brothers strongly united in control of Italy at the time. Perhaps I should say 2 males, one in the higher capacity and the other his chancellor, with whom I was involved as pope. And I sent armies to the north also. We had not yet begun the strong insistence upon indulgences, so I did not have that extra cash that indulgences would bring in. I believed and did not believe, as you,
to a class member,
earlier believed and did not believe, and I did a good job of hiding from myself what I believed and what I did not believe. And the higher one gets in power, the harder it is to hide such things from oneself. I was very fond of my first mistress, whose name was Maria, and there were no such sane rules as those in which you now sit, and there were no governments as secure in which you could reside as those you now enjoy. I did believe implicitly in the God in which I was brought up, and in that belief. It was only later that I wondered how such a God would choose me for such a position, and then I began to wonder. I had four lives following that of the most adverse circumstances, to make sure that I understood the difference between luxury and poverty, pride and compassion. And there were days in other centuries that I walked the same streets that I had walked as Pope. I touched these streets lightly as Pope, but as a peasant I walked with a heavy foot and great weight, until I learned the lessons that I had to learn, as all of you will also learn your own lessons.
At this writing, we do not know which Pope Seth referred to. When I came to type up this session, I wondered if Seth Jane's mention of the third century might be an error. If so, I hadn't been quick enough to catch it. I could have asked about it at once. Since Seth gave AD 300 in the class session for last May, I personally think it more likely that his papal incarnation followed this date, taking place in the fourth century. The fourth century encompasses the years AD 301 to 400. Since our modern computation of time is based upon the assumed date of the birth of Christ. The Encyclopedia Britannica lists 11 popes and two antipopes between AD 296 and 401. Some of the reigns were very brief, some of the dates of tenure uncertain or estimated. Of course, we would like to learn more about the incarnation in question. As Seth has already indicated, there is a wealth of information here waiting to be acquired. This brings up a dilemma Jane has confronted often. What to investigate out of the many possibilities available at any given time? Then, the choice made, how to find the time to carry out the study.
It is not my purpose to go into my past existences in any great detail, but to use them to make certain points. First of all, I have been many times both man and woman, and I have immersed myself in various occupations, but always with the idea of learning so that I could teach. I had a firm background in physical existence, therefore, as a prerequisite for my present work. I did not play the part of any towering personality of historical note, but became experienced in the homey and intimate details of daily life, the normal struggle for achievement, the need for love. I learned the unutterable yearning of father for son, son for father, husband for wife, wife for husband, and fell headlong into the intimate webs of human relationships. Before your idea of history, I was a Lumanian, and was later born in Atlantis. Using your historical reference, I returned at the time of the cavemen, operating as a speaker. Now I have always been a speaker, regardless of my physical occupation. I have been a spice merchant in Denmark, where I knew Rupert and Joseph. In several lives I was black, once in what is now called Ethiopia, and once in Turkey. My lives as monks followed my experience as a pope, and in one of these I was a victim of the Spanish Inquisition. My experience in female lives varied from that of a plain Dutch spinster to a courtesan at the time of the biblical David, to several existences as a humble mother with children. Now, when I began contacting Rupert and Joseph, I hid from them the fact of my numerous lives.
Smile.
Rupert, in particular, did not accept reincarnation, and the idea of such multiple life experiences would have been highly scandalous to him. The times and names and dates are not nearly as important as the experiences, and they are too numerous to list here. However, I will see to it at some time that these are made fully available. Some have been given in Rupert's class sessions, and some, though few, have appeared in the Seth material itself. In a book on reincarnation, I hope to have each of my previous personalities speak for themselves, for they should tell their own story. You should understand, therefore, that those personalities still exist and are independent. While what I am once seemed to be contained within those personalities, I was but the seed for them. In your terms, I can remember who I was. In greater terms, however, those personalities should speak for themselves. Perhaps you will see an analogy here when you compare the situation with age regression under hypnosis. Those personalities are not locked up inside of what I am, however. They have progressed according to their own fashion. They are not negated. In my terms, they coexist with me, but at another layer of reality. Now, take your break.
10:56. Jane said she'd really been out. As sometimes happen, memory and images connected with the material began to come back to her as we talked. She experienced a sense of expansion, an impression of great crowds. Then she remembered a stinking stall with dirty straw, and three men wearing dirty brown robes of pretty rough cloth. Jane sat half entranced, seeing more stuff now than in the session itself. It was as though a light within her focused upon one small area. She saw grease or wax from a candle falling upon one of the robes and staining it. In the stall there were long oval bundles of straw, stacked one upon another, to keep it dry, pretty high up to the roof. Each bundle is tied, but not covered. Now she smelled something very rancid. Seth has some kind of soap with his wares, some awful mixture with lye and rose water, she said, unbelieving, her nose wrinkling. This was in some kind of woven sack, a double one like you'd throw over a horse. I can almost see it in front of me. I could draw the shape of it, though it's not any big deal. That's it. All that opened up after you started talking about it, she said finally. I didn't have any bigger vision, and I didn't know how far to go along with it. When I saw the double sack, that's all I saw. Jane was obviously much more relaxed now than when she'd started this chapter. She was yawning deeply again and again, her eyes watering. I suggested an end to the session, but she wanted to continue. Resume at 11:19.
In several lives, I was consciously aware of my past existences. Once, as a monk, I found myself copying a manuscript that I myself had written in another life. Often I was given to the love of weight and possessed it. Twice I died of starvation. I always found my deaths highly educational, in your terms, afterwards. It was always a lesson between lives to trace the thoughts and events that led to a given demise. None of my deaths surprised me. I felt during the process the inevitability, the recognition, even a sense of familiarity. Of course this particular dying is mine and no other. And I accepted even the most bizarre circumstances then, feeling almost a sense of perfection. The life could not be finished properly without the death. There is a great sense of humility, and yet a great sense of exaltation as the inner self senses its freedom when death occurs. All my deaths were the complement of my lives, in that it seemed to me that it could not be otherwise.
Long pause at 11:29.
If I choose, in your terms, I can relive any portion of those existences, but those personalities go their own way. Do you understand me?
Yes.
On a subjective level, I acted as a teacher and a speaker in each of my lives. In a few highly intuitive existences, I was aware of this fact. You do not understand as yet the high importance of the underside of consciousness. Beside your objective role in each life, your reincarnational challenges also involve your dream states, rhythms of creativity that flow and ebb beneath the daily world you know. So I became highly proficient in this way as a speaker and a teacher in several lives that were externally uninteresting by contrast. My influence, work, and concern in such cases was far more vast than my quiet objective pursuits. I give you this information hoping to help you understand the true nature of your own reality. My reincarnational existences do not define what I am, however, nor do yours define you. Now, you may take a break or end the session as you prefer.
We'll take the break. 11:35. When I feel that Jane might choose to continue a session, I ask for a break instead of ending the session. It had been a slow delivery, and Jane knew she hadn't been out long. I don't know what to do now about continuing, she said after we'd talked briefly. I know what Seth's got planned, but I don't know how he's going to go about it. What's up? I don't understand. He's going to let Seth 2 come through. Seth 2 is dealt with at length in Chapter 17 of Jane's book, The Seth Material. This personality speaks occasionally in ESP class, but relatively seldom in our private sessions. In the outline Seth gave for this book before dictation began, we were told that Seth 2 would be explained. Some of our questions for Chapter 20 had concerned Seth 2 also. I'd forgotten both points for the moment, hence my surprise. But now, at 11:40, Jane didn't know whether to end the session, as I'd suggested earlier, or continue. She finally decided to just sit quietly for a minute. Then, I don't know whether to shut it down or not. It could go on for another hour. I told her I was game if she was. Seth resumed at 11:45.
Now, the soul knows itself and is not confused by terms or definitions. Through showing you the nature of my own reality, I hope to teach you the nature of your own. You are not bound to any category or corner of existence. Your reality cannot be measured any more than mine. I hope to illustrate the function of consciousness and personality through writing this book and enlarging your concepts. Now, I began by telling you that I was dictating this material through the auspices of a woman of whom I was quite fond. Let me now tell you that there are other realities involved. The following paragraphs will be written by another personality, who stands relatively in the same position to me as I stand to the woman through whom I am now speaking.
Pause at 11:51. I now watched a transformation begin to take place in Jane, as our familiar Seth retreated and Seth too began to come to the fore. At the same time, I knew that subjectively, Jane was experiencing the feeling of a cone or pyramid coming down over the top of her head. Jane has often told me that whereas she feels Seth come to her in a very warm and alive and friendly manner, she feels her consciousness going out of herself to meet Seth too. Up the invisible pyramid like a draft up a flue. She doesn't know where she goes or how she gets back. Her body seems to be left behind. Jane sat very formally in her Kennedy rocker, her forearms upon the arms of the chair, her feet flat upon the rug. It was a muggy night. Our living room windows were open, and now I became conscious of traffic noise. I heard someone moving about in the apartment upstairs. Jane's eyes were closed, but occasionally they opened slightly. She smiled faintly as she spoke for Seth, too. The voice that began to issue from her was very high, very distant and formal, with little volume or emphasis. Each word was carefully and deliberately, almost delicately spoken.